After we finished our talk on pride, we're moving into the opposite of pride. And the opposite of pride is actually not humility, like a lot of people think. Humility is simply the absence of pride. When you do not have any pride, you have humility. Because humility is just not thinking about yourself. Love is the true opposite of pride because love is actually a focus on others. So pride is self-focus, love is others-focused. And the Bible as a whole is filled with love. If you guys want to know the main theme of the Bible, it is love. You cannot go to a single section of the Bible that does not talk about this concept of love. Love is so important, it's so vital to the Christian walk, that Jesus himself said, the first and great commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. All of the law and all the prophets hinge on these two. That's what Jesus said. In our lives, there is nothing greater, there is nothing more important to study than love. In fact, the great love section of our Bibles that most of us know, if you've ever been to a wedding, secular or non, 1 Corinthians 13, that talks about love. It was written to a church that had all sorts of amazing spiritual gifts going on. People were speaking in tongues. People were prophesying. People were healing others. They were doing crazy acts of the Spirit. And Paul says, those are good. They have their place. But he says, I will show you a more excellent path than this. And he talks about love. Love is the one act, the one manifestation of the Holy Spirit that Satan actually can't replicate. Satan can replicate every other act of the Spirit, if you guys didn't know that, right? I could go to Mormons and I could hear them talking about spiritual gifts and stuff like that. I could go to Jehovah's Witness, hear them talking about that. I go to Hindus who chant and meditate, sometimes in tongues. But there's one act that Satan can never, ever replicate, and that is true, genuine, God-given love. It is the most important, the most essential thing that we could ever talk about. And that is why we're going to be spending the next couple weeks speaking on it, thinking on it, praying on it, and hopefully living it more and more. But before we get into this topic of love, before we even begin discussing how to love people, how to love God, which are the most important things we can do, we have to understand that love, first off, is something that is others-focused. It sounds kind of basic, but most of us, whether we believe it or not, most of our loves, the way that we love others, grows out of selfishness. I mean, the reason why we love people is because we're selfish. And if you think about it, it makes a whole lot of sense. When you're born, when you're a little kid, the first people that you loved were people like your parents, people who just took care of you, and you loved selfishly. You loved for what you can get out of the relationship, not what you can give. All of our loves are selfish because of that. We've never really truly learned how to love people for their sakes, and not simply for our own. And we're going to talk about how to do that tonight. But the other problem is that when we sit in church and we hear pastors like myself talk about love, we get all motivated and we get all excited. We're like, yeah, I'm going to go out and love people. But then we realize that the more we try to do it, the more we realize that we can't do it. Right? Not properly, not in the way that we want to. And it always seems a little bit hollow, like we're missing something, like we're not understanding something. And instead of engaging in something that's really beautiful and sweet and glorious, we instead engage in something that brings a lot of guilt and shame and despair into our lives. So we must learn how to love. It's very interesting that love in a person's life is much like language. You don't really learn language, you acquire language. I couldn't tell you guys how I learned how to speak, because what happened is after spending enough time with my parents and hanging out with people that talked around me, I acquired speech and I began speaking. Just in the same way, like none of us really remember how we learned how to love. You acquire that knowledge through looking at your friends and your family and TV and movies. And because of that, if you're anything like me, no matter how great the examples you might have are, they're flawed. They're flawed examples. And because of that, the way that we love is crooked. We'll talk more about that. So what does the Bible say is the first step? What do we need to do before anything else? 1 John 4, verse 19, we love because he first loved us. Our love that we as Christians exemplify to the world is in response to the love that we have first received. So before you can hear love as an action word, you have to hear love as a gift. If you have not received the gift of love, you have no hope to love in return. And that means, very simply, we must, when God and when Jesus tells us that we have to love, that that is the first and greatest commandment, that you must love God, you must love your neighbor, what we should be hearing is, I have to grow in my understanding, my experience, and my trust in God's perfect love in my life in order to then grow in loving God and others. That's how it looks. You cannot grow in loving God and others without first growing in understanding how much you yourself are loved. There's another passage in the Bible that explains this a little bit deeper. It's the passage that I've already referenced, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 1. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Paul here is talking about some of the greatest actions a person could take to love God and people, isn't it? I would say that speaking in the tongues of men and of angels and worshiping in languages that we can't even understand to the glory of God would be a pretty awesome act of love towards Him, wouldn't it? But what does Paul say? If you don't already have love, if you're not already loved by God, you're nothing but a clanging cymbal and a sounding brass. Even if you understand everything intellectually and you know all the Bible frontwards and backwards and all the doctrines of God are solidified in your heart, even though you have the best faith imaginable and trust in the promises of God, that you are unshakable, after all that, if you don't have love, you are nothing. And even if you try to love others to the extent that you will give them all the riches that you own and even your own body to be burned, if you don't already have God's love, it profits you nothing. Why is this? I'll give you two main reasons and we'll break them down over the course of tonight. The first reason is we have an inner emptiness. We've been talking about this over the course of our studies. But as human beings, we were born to receive God's love. And if we do not have that love within us, we are empty. We're like a vacuum. We're always reaching for something that's going to satisfy us, and that's why we sin. And if you think about that, you cannot love if you don't have that emptiness filled. It would be like this. It would be like if one of you who was incredibly poor had the best of intentions and said, I want to go out and I want to help a poor family. But if you don't have any money to your name and you go to that family, even if you have the best of intentions to help them out, you're going to end up taking more than you give. For those of us who have even the best of intentions to try to love people in our lives, if you are empty, if you are impoverished, and you have not received God's love, you will end up taking more than you give, no matter how good your intentions may be. The ironic thing about our society is that we actually glorify this. If you don't know this, then you must not listen to music or watch movies or TV ever. Right? When you listen to music, what kind of things do you hear about love? I need you. I want you. You complete me. As long as I have your love, everything is fine. I am nothing without you. Right? These are language that people use all the time in movies and in music and in TV. But what am I actually saying when I say that to my partner? I'm saying, I have a deep lack. And I have come into a relationship with you to take from you, not to give. You must come into my life to complete me because without you, I'm broken. And it sounds incredibly loving, but when you say that, who are you really thinking about? Yourself. The second problem is, I've already mentioned it, we don't actually know how to love. Now, if you grew up in a family that had absolutely perfect examples of love, then you actually don't have to listen to this sermon at all. But for the rest of us who grew up on earth, we have to listen to this. Doesn't matter how great examples you have, no matter how perfect they may seem, they're flawed. I have incredible examples of love in my life. My parents are incredible people, and I love them very much, and they're Christians, and they love the Lord very much. But they would be the first to tell you, don't look to us if you want to learn how to love. They would repeat exactly what Paul said. Imitate me as I imitate Christ. As long as I'm in line with the actions and the love and the respect of God, please imitate my life. But the second my life goes off of course, please stop imitating me. Right? We all have to say that because none of us are perfect. None of us have the flawless exemplifications of love in our lives. We're all missing the mark. Even if you hit the mark on love 99% of the time, that 1% of the time that you miss the mark, you can cause severe damage to yourself and others. We don't love perfectly. We don't even know how. And tonight, what we're going to be studying is we're going to be studying the life of a guy named Jacob. We're going to be looking at his life. We're going to be studying it. We're going to be seeing how this man does exactly what all of us do. He spent his life struggling for love, struggling to get love in his life, struggling to find relationships that would mean something to him, that would fill the inner emptiness that he felt all of his life. And we're going to see how he relates to us and why he could never love people, because he didn't know how and because he was empty. So to begin in his life, we're going to go all the way back to Genesis 25, verse 24 through 28. And this is before his birth. His parents were great people. Isaac, who was the chosen son of God from Abraham himself, and his mother, Rebekah, were about to have kids. And she's pregnant, and she said, I feel like I got a war going on in my stomach. I don't know what's going on. And she finds out that she had twins. And it says in verse 24, so when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So the boys grew, and Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man, dwelling in tents. And Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. But Rebekah loved Jacob. This is a very important section of Jacob's life. And the author of Genesis, in just a couple strokes, in just a couple sentences, has illustrated in a very detailed, impactful way what's wrong with Jacob. What holes in his life he's going to be trying to fill for the rest of his life. The first thing that we see is that the people we love most have the right to name us. Now, we don't really understand this too much in our culture, but in their culture, when you gave a name, you wouldn't just look inside of a baby book and say, like, oh, that sounds good, I'm going to name you that, right? In their culture, what you would do is you would wait for your child to come out, and a lot of times you wouldn't even name your kid for weeks after he was born, because what you'd be looking for is you'd be looking for some identifying trait to name your child after. Which is why Jacob and Esau get the names that they have. Esau's name literally means hairy, right? That's what his name means. Jacob's name literally means heel catcher, which is kind of like it's an idiom for somebody who uses treachery and deceit to get one up on people, right? Deceiver, trickster, one who contends for their own good. That's what Jacob means. And this name, obviously, is going to follow them around for the rest of their lives. This is true in our lives as well. The people that you love, the people you choose to love in your life, whether they be your parents, whether they be your friends, whether you be a lover, whatever, these people have a right to then identify you, to say what you are. And sometimes, a lot of times, the people that we love, they say good things about us. They say positive things about us. You're awesome. You're amazing. You're special. You're gifted, right? They say good things that build our identity. Right? They give us a secure identity and a foundation. When you're having a rough day, what do most of us usually do? We call someone, we text someone, we post something. Looking for what? The ones we love to build our identity. You guys get that? But here's the problem. Those same people that love you and can give you positive affirmation and positive identity have the most right to give you negative identity. Sometimes they do it on purpose. Sometimes they do it by accident. I truly believe that Jacob's parents did this on accident. they saw their kid and they're like, oh man, what a little heel catcher. Right, what a little trickster, you know, and they were just joking around with him. But that name sunk into Jacob. It sunk in so deep that this dude spends the rest of his life deceiving and tricking people, living down to the expectations of his given name, thinking that he has no value other than what he can take for himself. Right? This name defined him. And for us in our lives, the names that the people who love you, that they give you, is going to define you. You're going to live and die. You're going to be completely depending on what others say about you. Because the ones you love have the right to name you. And again, if the people that you love are perfect, and they're always going to give you a good identity, and they never falter, and they never say anything negative about you, and they never have bad days where they lash out at you, then you're good. You don't need this. But again, if you live on earth and you love people that are faulted and flawed and messed up, people that do have bad days, people that do lash out at you, sometimes for no reason, that harbor resentment and grudges, people who cut you down, sometimes without even knowing it, your identity is going to be in deep, deep trouble. Because people you love can name you. The second problem that we see inside of Jacob is that what we're really looking for when we're trying to love others is we're actually, whether we admit it or not, we're looking to be loved. We have a deep emptiness that we're trying to fill through the love of others. And if you notice something, Jacob absolutely has the love of his mother, but he doesn't have the love of his dad. And instead of thinking, I have the love of my mom, that's enough, he spends the rest of his childhood and early adult life trying to gain, trying to earn the love of guess who? His dad. It doesn't matter what love you have in your life. What you're always going to focus on more is the love you don't have. You could have hundreds of people in your life that tell you, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. But if one person in your life, especially someone as valuable as a family member, a parent, a spouse, a friend, doesn't love you, that emptiness is going to grow. You're not going to be able to get over it. You're going to always strive for their approval, just like Jacob does. You're going to strive to gain their acceptance because that's what's going to be missing in your heart and in your mind and in your life. And once again, if you're doing that, you're not loving. You're seeking love for sure, but you are not loving. And that led to deep amounts of rivalry between Jacob and Esau. See, instead of Jacob loving Esau as a brother and saying, you're my brother, I love you, he looked at Esau and he says, you're the favorite of dad. I'm going to get that from you, man. I'm going to get one up on you. You'll see. And he tries to live down to his name. He tries to use his deceit to do so. If you read through the story of Jacob, which most of you have, you know that what Jacob most wanted was the birthright. And he deceived two times to get it. One time he makes this pot of like awesome stew. Esau comes in, like most teenagers, and he says, I'm dying. And Jacob says, well, I'm making some stew for you. If you wait a little bit, I'll give you some. He's like, what good will stew be for me when I'm dead? You know, give me some now. You know, he's like total teenage boy. And Jacob's like, all right, man, I'll give you the soup if you give me your birthright. Right? And so Jacob uses his trickery to get it that time. And then the second time he uses it is to get the inheritance from his father. He tricks his dad. Because the dad wants to give the blessing to Esau, but he's losing his eyesight. So he tells Esau to go out and get him some food. And Esau goes out, and the mom and the son concoct a little plan to put one over on old dad. And they say, hey, why don't you put like some hair from a sheep on your arms, and then your dad will think that it's you, that you're Esau. And Jacob does this. He tricks his father. His father gives him the blessing. And you're thinking, like, why would Jacob want this blessing, especially since he never got it? Right? If you read the story, he never gets it because Esau becomes so murderous at his brother afterward, Jacob has to flee. It's like, why is Jacob trying to get this birthright so much? You know why? The birthright in that culture, it represented favor. Because the son that received the birthright was the son that was most respected, trusted, and looked after. It was the son that the parents looked at and be like, we trust our lineage to you. You are going to be the family name. You are going to carry on. We trust you, man. We love you. We respect you. Everyone's going to look up to you. And Jacob, wanting the approval of his father, wanting his dad to look at him and be like, son, I trust you. Son, I love you. Trying to get that affirmation he's wanted his whole life but never received, resorts to lying and deceit to get it. Not even thinking about the consequences of his actions. Not even thinking about the broken relationship he's going to create between him and his brother. He does it anyway. Because he's empty. You cannot properly love people when you're empty. So, once again, Esau runs Jacob out of the household. Jacob flees for his life. Ends up losing the only person that's ever loved him, his mom. He runs to the middle of the wilderness and he finds his mom's family, her brother actually, Laban. And he runs into Laban's daughter, Rachel. And he's immediately infatuated with this girl. He just falls head over heels for her right the second he meets her. In fact, it says he runs up and he kisses her, which is pretty forward, if you ask me. Runs up and he kisses her, and she doesn't slap him, surprisingly. And he's like, man, like, can I go back to your house? And she's like, sure. You know, obviously she didn't know about stranger danger. She's like, yeah, come back to my house. No big deal, right? She doesn't ask for ID or anything. She just trusts him. So he comes back to the house, and he finds out that Rachel has an older sister named Leah. And Leah is not as physically attractive as Rachel. So he meets Leah and they don't really have much of a relationship. But he goes and he sits down with Laban. And he says, Laban, I'm infatuated with your daughter. She's amazing. What would you take? Right? I don't have any money. Right? I can't pay any dowry. I can't pay a bridal price for her, which was customary in that region. What would you want for her? And Laban says, I don't know. What would you give me? So Jacob says, I'll give you 7 years of labor for her. Now, Jacob is not exactly a master barterer, right? Weddings cost a lot. Weddings usually don't cost 7 years' salary, though. Right? That's a bit excessive. He doesn't even lowball him. He's like, 7 years, man, because he's just so empty. He's so empty. He's so craving love that he's willing to give 7 years of his life for this girl. Just like that. And Laban says, okay, man, you worked for me 7 years. I'll give you Rachel. And that's where we pick things up in Genesis 29, verse 20 through 21. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her. Now, the first section of that verse sounds really, really precious, doesn't it? He worked 7 years, and it felt only like a few days to him, and because he loved her so much. I read that like, oh, how sweet. Jacob must have loved her so much. But then the second verse really reveals his heart, doesn't it? Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her. The English, you could kind of hear it a little bit. This is the most crass way possible for somebody to say, I want to have sex with that girl. It is the most crass way someone in that culture could have said it. So you think of all the English crass ways to say, I want to have sex with that person. That's what he said to her dad, right? Which is pretty intense that he did that. But he goes to her dad and he says, give me my wife that I may go into her. And you know what that shows? It shows that, yeah, Jacob served for 7 years and only seemed like a couple days, but it seemed like a couple days to him because he was lusting after Rachel. He wanted her. Because he said, surely Rachel will give me meaning. Surely Rachel, if I was married to her, my life would mean something. I would have value. I would have something. If someone that beautiful could love me, then I would have meaning. Then I would be able to look myself in the mirror and say, what a great person you are, for that woman loves you. Still looking for meaning and purpose in people. And you also see a little bit of entitlement. Jacob's not just struggling for love because he wants it. He's struggling for love, get this, because he feels like he deserves it. And once again, that's where a lot of us are. When we're talking to people, when we're engaging with them, we're doing it because we feel like we deserve love. And I'll give you a couple things that Jacob does to prove that he feels like he deserves it, and you can apply it to your own life, just as I do to mine. Because when I would look at my life, I realize I feel like I deserve love, and that's why I act the way I do. But after he gets married, a lot of you know the story, Laban does an old switcheroo at the wedding, and he switches Rachel for Leah. And Jacob is so lustful, so craving Rachel that he doesn't even notice. He has sex with her. He doesn't even notice that it's the wrong girl. Wakes up the next morning, sees it's Leah, freaks out, goes to her dad, says, "How could you do this to me?" Freaks out at him, and Laban says, "Hey, I'll tell you what, I'll give you them both. You just serve 7 more years for me, I'll give you both of them." And Jacob says, "Hot dog, let's do it," right? Doesn't even think twice. That's the first way that we know that Jacob feels entitled to this love. Never considers the impact that having 2 sisters married to you might have on the sisters. Doesn't even consider what this is going to do to my wives. Doesn't even consider. Think about it. Remember what Jacob struggled with his whole life? Being overshadowed by his older brother, always striving for the approval of his dad. And what's he doing? He's setting up the exact same situation with women that he supposedly loves. That they'll be striving for his affection. They'll be striving for his love. A lot of us do this, don't we? With flirtatiousness and things like that. Not thinking about the consequences of the ones that love us. We feel so entitled to it that we don't even consider what we're doing to others with our lust. Next, you see that Rachel and Leah have a little competition with one another. It's like a baby-making competition. Who can have the most fastest? And this competition gets a little sick if you want to read the story in your own time. But as the wives are going to Jacob and they're telling him this, he's just happy as a clam because he's having tons of sex. He doesn't even care about what it's doing to them, how much it's eating them up inside. In fact, at one point, Rachel looks at him and says, "Give me a child lest I die." She was so eaten up with insecurities that she's like, "If I don't have a kid, you might as well kill me because I have no value." And Jacob goes to her and says, "Baby, you know, I love you. You know, you're everything to me. How could you say..." No, he doesn't say that. He says, "Am I in the place of God to give you kids?" What's his response? "Don't bring that to me. Deal with it on your own time." Right? "If you want to have sex with me, give me a call, but I'm not going to deal with this crap." Right? And he goes off and he goes in the field. When you're entitled to love, when you feel entitled to love, you get bitter and angry at people for not loving you the way that you think they should. Right? They do things to you and you're like, "My wife shouldn't have done that. She ought to have treated me better than that." And you get bitter. Right? "My friends, man, they should have known that this meant something to me." Right? "They should have said happy birthday, but they didn't, you know." And you get bitter at people, you get upset with them for not loving you the way that you feel like you ought to be loved. Why? Because you feel entitled to it. And once again, he doesn't think anything of lying, cheating, manipulating to get what he wants, because ultimately he feels entitled to it. Love is one of the greatest justifiers for cheating, manipulating, and using people. Because all of us feel so empty, all of us feel so entitled to love that we don't think twice about manipulating those that we supposedly love. Because we feel like we are owed this kind of love. And eventually he grows cold. Eventually you see his love for Rachel and Leah just completely grow cold. He doesn't really seem to care for them too much towards the end of their relationship. Why? Because this thing that he thought was going to give him everything he wanted, this thing that was going to finally satisfy his soul, he has it and he feels more empty than ever. And instead of thinking, "Maybe there's something wrong with me," you know what he thinks? "There's something wrong with them. These girls, man, if they were prettier, if they were more compassionate towards me and my problems, maybe I wouldn't be so empty. But man, look at them. They can't even love right." He grows cold towards his own wives. Some of us, though, we flip back and forth between this. Not everyone is entitled to love all the time. Some points you're going to feel like you're completely undeserving of love. And to see this dynamic, I could go many places in the Bible to do this, but since I'm a lover of Disney, I want to try to add in a Disney reference as often as I can. So we're going to go to Frozen instead, because that's an awesome movie. And in the movie Frozen, we see 2 princesses who feel completely undeserving of love, and we see them react 2 different ways. The first sister is Elsa. You've never seen the movie. I'm going to give you hardcore spoilers. I don't care. It came out like 5 years ago. Get over it. All right. Elsa has ice powers, and in the beginning of the movie, she accidentally hits her sister Anna in the head, And she feels like a monster. She feels like, oh my gosh, all I do is hurt people. And so because of that, what she does is she shuts people out. She never gets close to anyone out of fear of hurting them. Now, this is obviously a pretty strong and powerful metaphor that when I say it that way, I hope it clicks with you guys. At some point, if you love people, you're going to mess up and hurt them. And when you hurt someone that you love, you're going to feel totally undeserving of love, and you'll probably pull an Elsa. You'd be like, oh my gosh, I'm a horrible person, get away from me, right? And you push people away because you feel like you're just going to hurt them. But in an effort to not hurt people, she ends up hurting them, right? The more she pushes people away, the more she abuses them, the more she ends up ruining their lives because, like it or not, they love her. So a lot of times, especially me, I struggle with depression. Most of the time when I'm struggling with depression, the lie that goes through my head is you are no good for anyone. You might as well just separate from them. Little do I know that when I do that, I make people think that I don't really like them too much, and it makes them insecure. And then when I hang out with those people the next time, they're a little awkward towards me, and I'm like, oh, this is proof they don't like me. And so it's kind of like a weird cycle, right? You push people away, they push you back, and then eventually you just end up apart, right? So that's how Elsa deals with her problem. How about Anna? Anna is a little bit different, right? So Anna is not someone that hurts somebody. Anna is someone that got hurt, right? She got hurt by someone who loved her. And she was the one, she was the victim, she got hurt, but her sister pushed her away. And so Anna develops a very deep relationship with her parents, but her parents end up dying. And so she grows up thinking that she is completely unworthy of love, completely undeserving of it. And I love Anna as a princess, by the way, because when you read the princess stories, when you watch any princess movie, let's face it, they're all damaged severely. Right? They're all either orphans, some bad juju's happened to them in their life. They're a little bit messed up. But they just end up finding their Prince Charming first try, right? They fall in love with the first dude they meet, and it just so happens to be Prince Charming, and their life turns out great. I love Anna's story because it's realistic. When you're a damaged person and you feel like you are unworthy of love, it sets you up for abuse. The first man that she meets is an abusive man. Someone so abusive that he even lets her die, right? He leaves her to die at one point in the movie. And again, I like it because Disney is showing a harsh reality, but they're using it in a kind of a whimsical way where kids can watch it and not be scarred for life. But what it's really showing is it's showing what can happen to someone who's grown up like that, completely feeling undeserving of love and loving the first person that they meet, dedicating themselves to that person, and expecting that person will love them if they just live a certain way with them and end up getting abused for the rest of their lives. That's what Anna does, because she feels like she's unworthy of love. Time and time again, when I counsel women that are with, it's most of the time women, sometimes it's men actually. I do counsel a lot of men that have this issue too with their wives, where they're clearly being used, clearly being abused by their spouse. And I'll ask them, like, why do you stay with this person? You know, why do you keep going back, right? They're the ones that are hurting you. Why would you do this? And they're just, and the answer is always the same. It's because I love them. But when you really talk to them and you really get down to the nitty-gritty, you realize that person doesn't need you. You need them. You are so broken. You are so empty. You feel so undeserving of love that deep down when that person abuses you, you feel like you deserve it. And you feel like that's because I need to love harder. Ernest Becker wrote a book called The Denial of Death. By the way, this guy was not a Christian. He was an atheist. He was writing about how mankind could get along without God. And he says a lot of times when we're trying to get along without God, we go to a romantic relation. We go to love to try to fill the void in our hearts. And this is what he says about that. After all, what is it that we want when we elevate the love partner to the position of God? We want redemption, nothing less. We want to be rid of all of our faults, our feelings, and all the nagging sensations of nothingness. We want to be justified, to know that our creation has not been in vain. We turn to the love partner for the experience of the heroic, for perfect validation. We expect them to make us good through love. Needless to say, human partners can't do this. The lover does not dispense cosmic heroism. He cannot give absolution in his own name. The reason is that as a finite being, he too is doomed. And we read that doom in his own fallibilities and his very deterioration. I hope you guys see what he's saying. We go to these people. We love people because we're hoping that they will give us some sort of validation, that we'll will somehow feel like our lives matter. But that person that you're going to, guess what? Is just as empty as you are, and they're looking at you for the same thing. Two poor people cannot possibly make each other rich. And two broken people certainly can't make each other whole. And we're all broken, and we're all looking for wholeness. And you're not going to find it. Not in the arms of another. Not in love. One last thing I'll mention about this before I move on to the next point. When it comes to someone like Anna, like a lot of us that are, we feel very undeserving of love, it also sets you up for intense amounts of manipulation. Because as you're seeking this love and approval from this other person, they have the right to just move you any way they want with their words. They know that just with one little phrase or look, they can totally throw you off. And a lot of them, especially the ones that are like Jacob, who feel entitled to love, who feel deserving of it, they will feel nothing as they move your heart back and forth and they abuse you. Fourth point, final point. This leads into what I said before, that we don't know how to love. So eventually Jacob tries to find love inside these people loving him. Doesn't work out, so he has kids. So you know what he does? Maybe I could find it in loving someone else, right? So he tries to love his kids. And what he ends up doing is he ends up loving Joseph more than all the others. He ends up favoring Joseph more than all of his other brothers. And now we see, more than anything else, that Jacob has literally become his own father. He has favored one son above the others, and he has poisoned his household. The brothers are murderous towards one another, so murderous that they throw Joseph into a pit and try to kill him. Now with Jacob, shouldn't that have like sparked off some things? Like, huh, I seem to remember having a brother that wanted to kill me for some reason. You know, like, why was that? And he probably should have thought of it. Oh, it was because of favoritism. But he does it anyway. Because like I said, you don't learn how to love, you acquire it. And that means that the way that you love is insidious. It means it just comes out of you. You don't even think about what you're doing. But then when you pause and reflect, you're like, oh my gosh, that's a lot like what I hated in my parents. That's weird. And I don't want to admit that, but a lot of the jacked up ways of how I love people, I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like what my dad used to do. And I didn't like it when he did that. But I'm doing it now. You live what you learn because there's nothing else that you have. You will end up repeating the mistakes of your parents because that's what you have. Right? Doesn't mean you will repeat all the mistakes of your parents. Right? We definitely will have our own unique failures. But what I'm saying is that a lot of your failures are going to be a repeat of what your parents did to you. Also, Jacob also finds that he cannot help but favor Joseph. In our lives, we have to understand this. We want to love like Jesus. Jesus says, love your enemies, right? Do good to those who hate you. What good is it if you love people who love you back? Even the non-believers do that. He says, if you want people to see love in your life, you love people who abuse you. And what we find is that we have no way of doing this. Because either we'll be like Jacob, we'll be like the entitled person, who we only love people who we feel like deserve it, or we'll be like Anna, where we feel so undeserving of love that in attempting to love these people that are unlovable, we'll end up being used by them, and we won't actually love them because we don't know how to be loved. We don't know how to have respect for ourselves. We don't know how to not enable people to abuse us, right? And that's the problem here. Jacob favors Joseph because guess what? He liked Joseph the best. That's really it. There's no secret here. There's no, like, I wonder why Jacob, maybe he flipped a coin and then it landed on Joseph. No, Joseph was just his favorite kid. He got along with Joseph the best, so he favored him naturally. That's what parents do, right? Why do certain parents favor certain kids over the other? It's not because they're evil. It's because they just so happen to like that kid the best. They're like, man, my personality jibes better with this kid than the others, and so they favor that kid. You see, in an attempting to love, they've created division and pollution because they don't know how. They don't know how to love the unlovable. They only know how to love those that they feel deserve it. Ayn Rand, who was a very famous writer, philosopher back in the day, she wrote the book Atlas Shrugged. when she was asked about this kind of selfless, sacrificial love, she says it's immoral to have a love that is placed above oneself. It's more than immoral, it's impossible. So the reason why she says it's so evil to say you should love sacrificially even those who don't love you back, she says you shouldn't do it because you can't do it. When you try to do it, you're going to fail. She says you love only those who deserve it. That was her philosophy. And it may sound harsh and cold to us, but it's realistic. You can't love people that don't love you back, not correctly, not in a way that's actually going to benefit them, and certainly not in a way that's going to benefit you. Finally, Jacob ends up having a terrible burden as a father. All the emptiness that he experienced in trying to receive love from people is magnified tenfold when he tries to love others. Because as he's loving these people, they're not appreciative of it. They have little squabbles and debates, and he's like, what do you want from me? Right? He gets frustrated at his sons. He doesn't understand why, but he gets frustrated at them, and a lot of times that's how we are. Even though we try to play the whole martyr complex of like, oh, I just love people, and I'm going to let them walk all over me, and I'm going to do everything for them, we realize very quickly that we get very bitter at them. Look at all that I do for you, and what do you do for me? Right? You just get very angry. You won't say it out loud, but in your heart, as you're doing chores, as you're paying for someone's meal, as you're driving them somewhere, you're like, man, this little leech, you know? Like in your heart, you'll feel that way. But you won't say anything because, once again, you're dependent on that person for your validation. The more you serve them and the more you feel used, the more you say, what a fantastic person I must be to love this person who doesn't love me back. See, you're not loving them, you're loving yourself. Ernest Becker, once again, talks about this. He says, on the other hand, what partner could ever want to give redemption? So the first time he said, if you love someone like this, it's because you're seeking redemption. But if someone loves you like this, that must mean you want to give redemption to this person. You want to give salvation to them, which only God can. Unless he was mad. Even the partner who plays God in the relationship cannot stand it for long, as at some level he knows that he does not possess the resources that the other needs and claims. He does not have perfect strength, perfect assurance, secure heroism. He cannot stand the burden of godhood, and so he must resent his own slave. So not only do you get resentful at that person for taking from you, but you also get resentful at them because you know deep down that you are inadequate, that you can't possibly give this person what they need. And so as they come to you and they look for this perfect affirmation from you, it's a burden that you can't bear, and you slowly, slowly you begin to feel inadequate and insecure, and all the things that you were looking over to get rid of through loving this person come rushing back to you with a vengeance. That's what Jacob finds. He becomes sick of all the people that he loves. This happens multiple times in his life, but I'm just going to point out this one because I think it's the most powerful. It's when God finally meets Jacob. Right? Jacob ends up facing everybody he loves. Everybody he loves. His own brother sets out to kill him. And he knows that his brothers are going to succeed. He knows that his brother's going to find him and he's going to kill him and his whole family. So Jacob, after he's failed everybody, he tells everyone to leave him and he isolates himself and he ends up alone. And he's just sitting there on the ground waiting for his brother to come and kill him. And that's where God meets him. Genesis 32, verse 24. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip went out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? He said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. What does God do for Jacob? This is the important part, right? This is the very important part. This is what God does for Jacob. This is what God does for us. First off, when Jacob meets God, his instinct is to wrestle with him, which sounds funny. But the reason why his instinct is to wrestle with God is because Jacob treats God just like every other person in his life. How do you get love from people in your life? You struggle for it. You wrestle. You prove your worth. You show your value. Then they'll love you in return. That's exactly how he treats God. All of us do this. This is not something that a select group of people do. Every Christian does this because we don't understand God's infinite love for us. We struggle to receive love from God. We do good deeds. We go to church. We read our Bibles, all the while trying to show God, you see how much I love you? Do you love me now? Do I value now? Do you care about me now? Am I good now? You're seeking from God the same thing that you're seeking from everybody else. You're treating God just like another human being in your life. You're wrestling with them just like Jacob did. And God's funny. Right? Instead of God just like smacking him, just like, what are you doing? You know, I'm God, and just like smacking him away. He lets him tire himself out. Right? He lets Jacob wrestle with him for the whole night. Right? God will let you do that. If you want to try to find value before God through good deeds, God will allow you to try to do that. And when you finally come to the end of yourself and you finally realize all the hope, all the trust, all the value I was trying to look for in my good deeds, I have found none of it. And you'll be broken just like Jacob was broken. God dislocates Jacob's hip. Now Jacob is in a place where he cannot stand, he cannot kneel, he cannot serve, he cannot wrestle. He can no longer struggle for love. He is a complete helpless man. And what does he do? He clings to the waist of God and he says, bless me. Why does God allow us to get to the place where we're broken? Whether we're broken like in my life, I was broken over sin. I tried my hardest to fight for love with God, to be good enough for God. And you know what I found? No matter how hard I tried, I could not stop viewing pornography. I tried for years and years and years, and I found no victory, and I just felt completely worthless. And I realized, what use could I be of God if I can't even stop doing something he's commanded me to do? And that was the moment. I still need to come back to this moment like Jacob does. But that was the moment where I first realized God doesn't need me to love him. God simply loves me. Jesus is broken for us. See what the gospel reveals to you and me? All our lives we're trying to get to God. All our lives we're trying to be good enough for him. Well, what does God do? He comes down to us. Lives a life for us. Is broken, beaten, savagely put on a cross. Bleeds out for us. See, Jacob was broken so God could show him how much he loved him. Jesus was broken for us so God could show us how much he loves us. That is the beauty of the gospel. That is the beauty of the cross. Jesus did not demand his disciples to get on a cross for him. He got on a cross for them. God loves you first. Then you love in return. The second thing that God does for Jacob is he gives him a new name. He calls him Israel instead of Jacob. Israel is a really beautiful name. You know what it means? It means God contends. Remember what Jacob meant? Heel catcher. One who contends for himself, right? One who seeks his own good. One who tries to persevere for his own good. What is God saying to you? Your name's no longer Jacob. Your name is Israel because I contend for you. You spent your whole life trying to get what you wanted, right? Your whole life trying to be loved. And what did it get you? Nothing. But this is your new name, Jacob. I contend for you. I love you. That's your new name. That's your new identity. That's your foundation. The Christian must understand this. This is your foundation for identity now, that God loves you. It's very interesting that John, who writes the most about love out of any of the other apostles, you know what he calls himself over and over again in his own gospel? The disciple whom Jesus loved. Never uses his own name. You know why? Because he says, John is no longer my identity. My only identity is I am the one whom Jesus loved. That's the only thing about me that matters anymore. The most powerful, the most beautiful, the most glorious being in all the universe loves me, and that's what completes me. It's not going to be my parents. It's not going to be my friends. It's not going to be my family. It's not going to be my husband or wife. It's not going to be my kids one day. It is God who loves me, and that is my identity. That's who I am. And this truth answers both questions of the person who's entitled to love and the person who feels undeserving of love. Because you know what the Bible says to us? You are undeserving of love. But you know what? You have it anyway. It heals both. The person who feels entitled to love has to admit, I am not entitled to love. And the person who feels undeserving of love has to admit, but I am loved. Regardless of how I feel inside, regardless of what I think about myself, that is the truth. I'm undeserving, but I have it anyway because of the grace of God. You see, being filled by God, finally will allow you to truly love people without being abused by them. It gives you a firm identity that can't be pulled by anyone's manipulation or abuse. See, the reason why we become abuse victims is because we feel undeserving. We allow people to dictate how our life is going to be because we have that vacuum in our hearts. We're trying to find something from them. We're trying to live up to their standards. The Christian is so filled by the love of God that they don't need that anymore. You know what that frees them up to do? To love them. To love them. To not be pulled by them, but to love them. And it also allows you to love people that you may even feel deserve it. Right? There's a lot of awesome, amazing people in my life, but you know what? They're not perfect. The only being in this universe that deserves love is God. Everyone else does not deserve love, including me. And if you try to love people because you feel they deserve it, you're not going to be able to love them. And a lot of times in our language, we say things to try to justify loving people. Like, why do you love that person? Like, oh, they're awesome. They're amazing. They're a musician. They got great hair, right? Why do you love that person? Oh, well, they're my dad. I got to love them. You know, they're my brother. I got to love them. You know, they're my aunt. I got to love them. You know, you're trying to justify your love for this person. You know what the Bible says? Stop it. They don't deserve love, but God loves them anyway. And because he loved them first, you can love them. Right? That's the truth. And think about how amazing that is. The only being in this universe that deserved love was forsaken. The only being who deserved to be brought in because of his merit, right? The only being who could have possibly stood before God and say, I deserve love, was cast out, was forsaken. One of the last words that he said on the cross was, my God, why have you forsaken me? Right? Jesus was forsaken so that you could be brought in. The only one who deserved it, let it go for you. So that even though you don't deserve it, you have it. And to the level you understand that, to the level that you believe that, to the level that you trust that and experience that, that's going to be the level that you're going to be able to love others. You could try all you want in your own strength, but you will never be able to love others until you believe this, until you accept it. That's why in 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18, it says, we all, with unveiled face, beholding the beauty of our Lord, are being transformed into the same image from one degree of glory to another. For this comes from the Lord, who is Spirit. How do we become like God? It's not through trying, it's through receiving, observing, studying, diving into, experiencing. That's how it happens. So that's the beginning of the study of love, and I hope you guys are grabbing this. I encourage you guys in your own time, read 1 Corinthians 13 on your own time, study it, pray on it, see the areas that you fall short and think, God, why am I not trusting you in this? Because the reason why I lack patience, God, is because I feel entitled to love. And I don't have patience for the people in my life because I'm seeking them instead of you. The reason why I'm seeking my own God is because I'm not seeking you. The reason why I'm not bearing all things, the reason why I'm not hoping all things, the reason why I'm not believing all things is because at the end of the day, I don't trust the one who makes all things possible. God, teach me to rely on you. Teach me to trust you. Let's pray. God, we want to thank you for your supreme love. We want to thank you for your joy and your goodness in our lives. Please help us to trust this love, God, that it's there and available for us. Help us to believe in it. Help us to experience it by your Spirit. God, fill us to fullness by your goodness and yours alone. And then teach us to love like you. We're very, very thankful for you, God. And in your name, amen.